This is Colleen Levy, recorded at the Marguerite Bay reunion at Bowness on Windermere by Chris Alden Lee on the 30th of October 2010. Colleen Levy.
Well, my current name, I'm a divorced woman. My name's Colleen Levy, and I was Roland's before I got married. And I'm 75. My birthday is the 23rd of May 1935. And I was born in Port Stanley. I think it was called the King Edward Memorial Hospital, a daunting place. But I grew up there, and then I went up to Uruguay, to Montevideo, to the British school. And when I came back from there, I think I was about 17, I was offered a job in Government House working for the FIDs. I never knew very much about them at all, as one doesn't. I only realised that when I came back from school, I was still in ankle socks and wearing a school uniform almost. And all the girls that I knew as youngsters when we were all at the Falklands School, that they were all with lipstick, masses and makeup, hairdos, nylons with the seams up the back and high-heeled shoes. So I was sort of like a fish out of water.
Out of your own time?
Yes. Yeah.
Why did you go to Monty to go to school? Were you particularly bright?
I think I was when I was young, but I've lost most of that. I've retired in age as well as thinking.
So was it a convent school?
No, it was the British school, the only English school there, and most of the girls were daughters of embassy staff or business people in Uruguay, and that was a lovely time. I made friends with two girls in particular, and one I really liked was that her father had an estancia out there, and holidays we would go out to this place, and it was lovely. We rode horses and drove cattle and wore ponchos, and it was absolutely fabulous. So then I wanted to be a work on a farm in my dreams, because I knew that I liked horses very much, but that never came fruition.
Did you go to that school because your parents are quite well off then?
No, I went there. It was a government scheme. I had a very close... My parents were divorced, and of course my father must have had visiting rights in those days to me, so he sort of saw me, but I lived with my mother, and yes, I did fairly well at school, so I can remember coming home from school one day and finding someone talking to my mother in our kitchen, and my mother said, "Oh, would you like to go away to school?" And I thought, yes, anything than getting being stuck here. So that was how that happened.
But so even as a child, you felt that the Falkland Islands were a restriction, did you?
Well, not so much a restriction, but I didn't feel I belonged.
Do you know why you felt that?
Well, I suppose their divorce.
Right, of course. So fresh start, really.
Yes, it was that I was obviously petrified and dead scared of what was going to happen. But it worked out well. I enjoyed the time there. And when I came back to Stanley, I offered a job to work at Government House for FIDS, and I never knew what all this was about. And I don't remember the names of the governors or anything.
But would it be Miles Clifford?
Yes. Oh, yes. I thought he was Hitler.
I beg your pardon?
I thought he was Hitler because he had a little moustache and he had that sort of... I don't know whether I'd seen a war film or something, but I felt he wasn't who he said he was. But that was just in my dreams, I guess, and my imagination.
So we're now talking about 1952, I guess, are we?
Yeah, well, a bit before that, I would think. There was a one before him who was extremely nice, but Miles Clifford was a strange man.
Mm.
and his wife was a very nervous little lady.
What did he make of her?
Well, I felt like saying, "Oh, don't worry. I can. If you want me to do anything." Because when they had tea parties or cocktail parties, they always sort of suggested I went as, as a guest at these parties, which was a lovely introduction for me to sort of become more independent. And I also worked as a radio announcer. "Hello, this is the British Broadcasting Corporation in Port Stanley. I have some local news. Mr. Jim Clifton has fish for sale at the public jetty. Would you please bring your own basins?" And I can remember it was so amusing, and I thought, what on earth is happening to me? So I did that to save money to pay for a trip to my trip to England, because we always called England home. And additionally, when I was, I don't know how old I would be, but it was years before that the Sunderland flying boats came to Stanley, only one trip, and I was fascinated, and I thought, oh, I wish I could go on those.
Would you think you were a bit of an ambitious young lady?
Yes.
Wanting to move on in the world?
Oh, yes, I felt I had to move away before I could do anything.
So the work at Government House... Were you a secretary to FIDS or...?
No, not to FIDS. I was just one of the staff.
Actually, as a domestic staff?
No, yeah. In the office, in FIDS office. And I did a lot of the paperwork for the FIDS when they came in. They had to have their kit. And I can always remember being quite amused, because I was such a naive, innocent little soul, that when we looked through the list and had to tick who had this and who had that, and I always used to get down to the one that said housewives, and then it said in brackets, "for the use of." And I thought, I wonder what that means. And then I realised, of course, it meant a little pair of scissors, some thread and a needle or two to mend socks or whatever. Yeah. And
Was there a family atmosphere at Government House? Did you feel as though you kind of belonged to the family, or were you definitely an employee?
Well... It was just you fitted in, but I wouldn't have said it was, everyone was, well, I mixed very well, and particularly I think the governor before Miles Clifford was, they were a lovely family. And then after Miles Clifford, I can't remember who they were, but I know that one of the governors had two Springer Spaniels, and I had a collie dog that I was given by the Marines when they had to when they left the Falklands. And I can remember that very well, because I used to take this dog into the office and worry that those two Springers would come in, and would they fight, and how would I get them apart? But nothing ever happened, so that was okay. And then in the evenings, I went down to the broadcasting station and did all this, because we had everything on huge records. And I used to introduce the records and play opening music and that sort of thing from discs.
So you were operating it, were you?
No, they had a
technician with
you. A technician, yes. He was in behind the glass. And one night I was there, and it was the dog was sitting down there, and he went to sleep and he started snoring. And I didn't know how to sort of shush and stop him when I was trying to read something. So that was the amusing time I had there. So I...
Subject, do you remember any radio programmes by a chap called Ellery Anderson?
No.
Expedition South?
No.
No. That may have been before your time, I guess.
I think it might have been.
Yeah. But all this was aiming towards trying to get away from the Falklands.
I didn't want to marry a local boy because I felt some of them were pretty rough.
You knew one or two local lads, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to school with them. Yes, there was this Rowley Summers, and all about three or four boys that I must have gone to school with younger.
Who went into FIDS?
No.
Well, Ian Biggs?
I don't know what he did.
He went south and became a FID.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Mm.
I probably do, but I don't sort of remember an awful lot. It's so many years ago.
Yes. And the other name that you might remember is Arthur Martin.
Oh, my love, yes. He's a sweetheart. I was very chummy with him, and I was bridesmaid at his wedding. And, yes, he was a great person. And
he still is, you know. He's still with us. Yeah,
I know he's Hampshire. Had... And they have two grown-up daughters. And I can remember, because I bred dogs for about 20 years as well when I lived down there in Hampshire. I moved down to Hampshire. And I remember going down to see Arthur, and I took two of my boys. And they were so patient with me, because when I went in their little porch, they had slippers put out in order. And I think, oh, what a lovely family. They all have their slippers put left out in the porch so that they can leave their shoes indoors. So that was...
You also... Now, I interviewed a chap about a year or so ago called Lofty Tyson.
Oh, I know Lofty, yes. He was one of the men that came down to the Antarctic. A tall, blundering sort of chap, yes. Very quiet. And he wasn't a good conversationalist. So Lofty Tyson, yes, he was one of... I don't know when he came down originally, but he went down again, I think. I don't know the year that he was in FIDS or the years he was in FIDS. Mm. And, yes, I got to know him.
Did you... Did you see him socially?
Well, quite often they had cocktail parties and things, and yes, I bumped into him every now and again. And I think he probably wrote to me. I can't remember. But we kept up this friendship and occasionally telephoned, and he came over to see me when I first moved up to from Southampton, where I lived at the time, up north here to Dent. And I brought all my dogs up with me. There were not hundreds of them, but I had quite a few.
You didn't go to the cinema with him, did you, in Stanley?
Probably did. I used to go to certain dances on the Saturday.
Yeah.
And, of course, everyone came, and I can remember sort of thinking, what can I put on to go there? Because it's bitterly cold, and it would probably be raining or snowing when I came out. But, yes, I think there's certain groups of FIDs that you always spoke to. And John Green, I loved him as well. He was a dashing little gentleman, ADC to the governor, and used to wear those tight trousers with the gold strip down the side. And Frank Elliott, he was the boss man at the time as well.
He's now 100 years old, Frank.
Is he still alive?
Yes.
My goodness.
Well, he was last time I heard.
Yes. Oh, good. And then I did all the coding, and because everything came up in coded message from the bases.
You mean the weather reports, that kind of thing?
No, everything, whatever happened. Right. And you had two books, and you had to sort of get from certain words other letters and then go into the second book, and that told you what the word was. It would take ages. I can't remember. I can only remember very clearly I had several codes to do, and there was this particular one I started off, and it started off with, regretfully, we have to say that Arthur Tarrant shot himself yesterday or whatever. And I couldn't believe, I thought, this is something, you know, this is just a joke or something. So I went out to Frank and I said, I'm sorry, but would you mind sort of checking over this code, because I can't work it out. They say Arthur Farrant has shot himself, and he had. And that was really sad. And I read it not so long ago where they listed obituaries, and that was one of them was... Arthur Tarrant. I don't know what
Tarrant year that or was. Farrant?
Farrant. Farrant,
yes. Yeah.
Mm.
Yes, he received a Dear John letter, apparently.
Oh, I didn't know why. I thought, I know he was a quiet bloke, quite sort of moody. I thought he was moody, but he was probably trying to cope with what was going on in his world. But I was very sad about that. But that was the only sort of bad thing that I can remember coming out of those codes.
The information you were receiving, would it therefore be fairly secret information?
Yes, it was.
Or was it coded to avoid the Argentinians getting at it?
I think a bit of both.
Yeah. So you were in a position of trust then, really?
Oh, yes, it was lovely. I used to sit in my little office behind Frank Elliott's and beaver away at these codes, and then I had to recode things back again.
Mm.
But that was just sort of, it's almost like a passing thought.
Did you ever make any mistakes, any blunders, or were you aware of any like Chinese whispers type things?
No, I don't think so, because there was nothing else that was in my world that would make me think it was gossip.
Hmm.
Maybe there was a short sentence to say, it's bloody cold or something like that. But all those uncoded messages had to go through to the governor, because obviously he had to know. And then he and Frank went in discussions over these things, and then obviously they made decisions and made sure that everything was put in place. But I never got to that stage.
Mm.
It was just that I had to do the groundwork, so to speak. Mm. But it was good. And I came across a photograph of Frank Elliott and me and Margaret Northwood. She was the daughter of the head of Public Works, would it be? I can't remember. And they lived up on a corner. And we used to go out quite a lot with Rosemary Gird. And we were quite chummy and went to the pictures in the town hall, I think they were. Can't remember any of the films, but I thought they were wonderful. And this is where I'll be, and I'll do this, that, and the other. So I suppose it took me a few years to save up my fare for the trip over. And then I just sort of left.
Well, before we get to that next step in your life, tell me a bit about playing the organ at the church.
Ah, well, I was a Sunday school teacher. Mm. And I'd also had music lessons with a Mrs. Robson who lived in Fitzroy Road. I remember that. And I can remember not practising one day. And I tried to practise, but it was a bit boring and I wanted to do something else probably. And I went to her and she said, oh, did you enjoy this piece of music? And I said, oh, yes. And it was whether you cross over the hands, and I've forgotten now completely how that happened. But I can remember she picked me up and said, I don't think you practiced this very often, did you? And I said, no, I'm sorry, I didn't. And anyway, I used to go to, well, as most girls, they had to go to church in the morning, and then you had the children there, and I had the lesson to give to the children. It was lovely. They were such sweet kids. Little holy terrors, I think, when they got out of church, but wonderful to teach, and they were bright. And there was one particular little boy, I don't remember his name, he was very bright, and I enjoyed that part. And then someone said, oh, you can play, you'll play the organ. I said, play the organ? I'm not qualified to do that. And anyway, it was just sort of, you pick the hymns. And I had Roly Summers as the chap that pumped up the organ around the side. And I know he used to always come in at the last minute. And I was thinking, God, I hope I can remember it and don't press the wrong notes. I think I might have once or twice, but I played fairly well at the time.
And at the BBC radio station, did you ever get involved in a programme called Calling Antarctica?
That was before my time.
That was coming from London, wasn't it?
It must have been.
And were there other FIDs you remember passing through, anybody you got to know as they passed through Stanley?
Well, I knew them all to talk to, but not to sort of know very well. There are lots of names, but all the photographs I've had of sort of FIDs outside the hut and the snow up here, and then big glaciers. I seem to remember someone called John Noble, but I noticed in the obituary there was someone called John Noble who had died, but this chap was quite artistic. And I know when they came back after their time down there. This chap gave me a piece of whalebone, and he'd painted on the emblem of Fids with a sailing boat, and I can't think what else, but I've kept that, and I hang it up in my house, and it's and he even put in two screws to so that I could put rope, some cord in there to hold it up.
I would imagine with all these young men passing through Stanley and the traditional party at the governor's house, that the young ladies of Port Stanley might be quite popular for dances, mightn't they?
Well, everyone went to the dances on a Saturday night, and people used to come up and ask you to dance. Not that I was a good dancer, but I could
you were
manage.
A lady, and you were a female in a skirt, actually.
Yeah, yes, yeah. All bound to be. and then all the boats were in, and I was also invited on board all the ships that came in to the harbour. And that was, I knew all the midshipmen, and they were lovely, all well-educated chaps and good senses of humour. So the invitations on board, I've kept all the invitation cards, so I looked at them. I think Berrien Bay, I had about 8, so I thought they must have been there at least 8 weeks. And it said the boat, I don't know what they call it, will pick you up at the public jetty at 7 o'clock for 7:30.
And the tender.
Eh?
The tender.
Yeah, the tender, that's right, yes.
Yeah.
And, that was quite exciting, and I almost felt I was on my way somehow. And
so how did you escape from the Falklands to England? What was it that what was the turning point?
Well, it was just that I had the money, and my nana gave me £100, and I thought, God, I'm a millionaireess now. And so I booked my ticket.
And your mother was quite agreeable to the idea of you leaving?
Well, we were strangers. You know, I'd been away in those sort of growing up years, and I'd had wonderful sort of friends, and it was a different lifestyle. And when I came back, it was almost, everyone else had the life, and there wasn't any crack that I could join into. So I was really pleased when I had the money, and I didn't regret it. I obviously felt very sad going, but I knew this is what I wanted. So I came on the RMS Andes first class because I had enough money, and I thought, if I don't do anything else anywhere, I'll just sort of enjoy this trip. And that was, you know, very formal. And I sat at the chief engineer's table. And I feel if it was to go over again, it would be so different. And life was so colonial. You know, all the people I mixed with in Uruguay, they were all the colonial set. So they were a big clique of things. And being friendly with Elizabeth Abel, I think the name was. So I sort of went into their homes quite often for tea or whatever. And then we had summer holidays, and we went out to one of the seaside, like coming down to Windermere, but local, and we used to hire American bikes and ride around all the roads and paths, and that was really enjoyable. So, no, with no regret, I felt that I really needed to get away, to escape, really, from... Where would I end up if I stayed in the Falklands? Married to a local yokel? No, thank you.
And so you arrived in the UK?
Yes, and I had a telegram just before I arrived to say that please get in touch with the Crown agents, as we would like someone in the office, in FID's office in the Crown agents, for the IGY International Year Expedition. Run by Dr. Fuchs. So I went into the office, and there was the lady called Barbara, and I don't remember her surname.
Honeywell?
I don't know.
Okay.
And she was working for the Crown agents, and I was in her office, so to speak. And I just had to do all the paperwork that I did in Stanley, really, for FIDs and kitting them out and being the contact for their families. And that only lasted a year. I never saw Dr. Fuchs because he was up in Cambridge, I think.
Well, he was also in the Antarctic, wasn't he?
Yeah. Mm.
So you were mission control in the UK, mission control.
Absolutely, mission control Bwana. Yeah. And so that was a year, and then
What did you make of London when you saw it for the first time? Because some Falklanders really find it quite daunting.
It is terribly daunting because I arrived at what is the name of the docks?
Tilbury
docks, and all I saw were these very high things with men in little boxes in the top going whizzing to and fro and picking up huge things and putting them in the hold of a ship. And it was all dirty, it was very smelly, and it was foggy. And I thought, what the hell have I done? But I'd also got B&B booked up in Hampstead. And I lived with an elderly lady there, and she was wonderful. I used to travel down. I could never go on the underground because I was too scared of that. I thought I'd fall over and be squashed or something.
Mm.
So I went on buses for ages, and then I thought one day, no, I'll go on this train. And, of course, that was very complicated, looking at all the blue line or the yellow line or whatever. Eventually I overcame that. And so then I was coming to the end of this IGY year, and I thought, well, what can I do now? I've got to go and do something else.
Mm.
And I also did night school for Pittman's secretarial, so I knew a little bit more about typing. And I thought, I'll write to the airlines because maybe I could fly around the world as a hostie.
So how long were you with the Crown Agents for then, just for 1 year?
I think it was over a year, but it wasn't long.
Right. Okay. And then British Airways, or was it BOAC in those
BOAC,
days?
BOAC, British Overseas Airways Corporation.
That's it.
So I wrote to them and I went up for several interviews. And then they took me on. And the real idea was to open up South America, but I don't think they did for ages. And I was assigned to Britannia 102s, the whispering giant of the time, you know, the latest thing out. And girls I was on the course with, no one else came on Britannias. They all went on Argonauts or Stratocruises. So then it was petrifying. The training was quite stiff. And we had to report into Building 221, at Staines somewhere, and that was a Nissen hut. And they used to take us out in a coach to the aircraft. And on my first trip, and I knew nothing about flying, I was so naive, it was amazing. I seemed to think of, how didn't I read it or look it up? And it was all this like this, the customs and things you got on the aircraft, and then you had to make sure all the food was in the little containers, etc., and that the seats were this and the belt had to be like that. So the first trip I was quite sick, and I took some anti-sick pills, and I can remember having to be in the middle of serving a meal, and I thought, I'm going to be sick any minute, so I'd have to run back to the toilet and throw everything up that I'd eaten, and then go back after I'd had a drink of water as though nothing had happened. So it was quite... And we did have a scare on the way down because we'd just left Darwin, which was sweltering hot, and I wasn't used to sweating all the time. The pilot called me up and said, oh, we've had an emergency. We've got to go into Cloncurry. One of the flying doctors has crashed and he's had a bad head injury. So we had to divert. So I had to, can I have your attention, please? The captain has asked me to let you know that we're taking a small diversion into Cloncurry. And that was near Alice Springs, I think. And we landed in this then unused aircraft thing. And we got to the end of the runway, and then we had to go forward and sideways and turn the plane around. And the tarmac crumbled underneath the nose. So the poor old nose went slowly and elegantly down. And we were there for quite a few weeks because we couldn't get out of the...
ground.
Ground. So all the locals were there in their jeeps, and there were no sort of lights on the runway, so they all had to put their lights full on for the pilot to land. So that was quite exhausting, but...
You were there for several weeks, were you?
Yes.
And all the passengers had to stay in hotels.
Well, there weren't those sort of things in these days. Quite. We were just put up... I was put up with the sheriff and his family, and they were gorgeous, but all the houses were up on stilts in those days because of things coming in. I don't know what were there. Wouldn't be crocodiles or anything, but there were obviously things that would get into the house and cause a problem. And so, yes, it was lovely. It was baking hot, and, oh, you had to stay in your uniform and you couldn't unpack or anything, so it was a bit rough for a while. But then they managed to get some lifting and pull the aircraft around, and they found it hadn't any damage. So I think we were there a month, I'm not sure, but they had to have some parts sent out from UK. And
whatever happened to the flying doctor?
Well, and there again, another aircraft was just passing at the same time, and they responded as well. But there was a light aircraft, so they landed easily and took him down to Sydney, I guess. Mm. So we never saw this poor pilot who was all crunched up.
Mm. Obviously, we're mainly talking about the Falklands in this interview.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering if you ever went back.
No.
You never went.
I never wanted to. I knew I'd made a break. And I thought, well, I didn't have a close family because of parents being divorced. So there was never the urge to go back. There was sort of a query about what was happening in the Falklands. And
in 82,
rather. 82, yes. Mm. And I thought, I wonder how they're coping. And seeing the flashes on the news, I wondered what would happen to all the people. And I thought it was a war that was so unnecessary. And they lost a lot of lives there, both with the Argies and the British. And
did your mother or your family ever come to England?
My mother was sent to England. She had several heart attacks, and they had given her 3 months to live. So I was the eldest daughter, and my sister by this time was ensconced either in Brazil or the States or somewhere with this Mick Green, who was the ex-pilot, and he was down south sometime or other, but I never got any details because he was killed, not through a plane crash, but I think there was a big hurricane or something, and their taxi was blown into the water on the way to the hotel.
In which country?
Australia.
Right.
That was a bad time for her, but we weren't close either. So
your mother came to England in the end?
Well, in the end, they sent her to England, and I didn't know who I was looking for, so I went up to Heathrow, and someone came up and said, oh, your mother's just getting off the aircraft now, and my mother was really poorly, so I had to get, today we'd get carers in. Well, I don't know what they were called in those days, probably still carers. So I had to get her in... the people to come in and sort her, and it was so expensive.
Mm.
And so she lived quite a few years, and she got through the heart attacks, and she had a few friends from the Falklands who came and visited. And then I thought, well, I must have a dog. So I bought two red setters, two bitches, never bred from them because they were really pet quality, but I didn't know a good one from a bad one then. So then I took up as a hobby.
You ran dog kennels, didn't you?
Eventually. Yes, yeah. And I showed dogs a lot.
So since that era,
yeah.
Have you had any more dealings with FIDS, or British Antarctic Survey, as it's called today?
Well, the British FIDS, well, I've always been in touch with Arthur and Lofty. Lofty rings me up, he's a strange bloke. I don't know whether you've ever spoken to him.
I've met him, yes, about a year ago.
He's not a talker. Yes, he's not a talker, though, and he's sort of, like, is quite stern, and he just tells you what he wants you to know. I just open my mouth and everything vomits out. But yes, he was a strange man, but very kind to me. He came and with another chap, and I think it was another FID, and the kennels I had apparently had no support on the roof, and if we'd had a bad storm or anything, the roof would have blown off, and I thought, oh my God. But Lofty said, oh, don't worry, I'll do that. I can come over and with someone, and we'll just mend it up. We'll put a few more supports in for you, which was lovely.
So those early contacts have been with you for most of your life.
Yeah.
And now you're a member of Bass Club.
I am. I've only joined a few years ago, and that was Lofty. He sent me a ticket or a compliments card or something. I've paid your first year's membership fees to Bass, and I said, oh, that's lovely. And he said, well, I'm going next year, so if you want to be my guest, it's a day thing and an evening thing. And it was somewhere near Settle. And when I drove past and I thought, am I there yet? And I saw this young man's, it looked to me like YMCA, but I don't know. It was sort of a school of some sort. It could be a summer camp for children or something. And that was my first, and I didn't know anyone there, so I had to stay with Lofty. I was going further on to do some business, and so I stayed at a B&B, and that was the place where it was full of artificial flowers, and there was lots of stairs to go up, and there were all these ornaments of dogs or posies, and this huge display of artificial flowers. But I found it very smart. I was smiled all the time because it was really quite funny, and the lady was so posh and so lovely. And I stayed there two nights and then carried on and working it.
But Bass Club has helped you out, hasn't it, Annie?
Oh, it's been wonderful, yes. And I think this was Lofty again. He said, you know, there's a benevolent fund, and he said, I've asked Leet to ring. I said, who the hell is Leet? I don't know anyone called Leet. And he said, oh yes, it's Leatrice Peck, I think was her maiden name. And so next minute, I'm Leet. And I thought, I don't know anyone called Leet. And I said, I only know a girl that used to be in the Falklands called Leatrice. She said, that's me. And so she said, well, the benevolent of Bass. And I said, I don't know what Bass is. So he must have then told someone, or I also spoke to Arthur, but it wasn't about the benevolent fund. I just wanted to see how he was, his health was, and how. And he had rung me to say that and so he must have phoned Lofty, or Lofty phoned him.
I think it was a conspiracy, couldn't it?
Yes,
yeah.
The two of them got together.
To get you this special chair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've got a lovely recliner chair now, which is wonderful. And it puts my feet up, and if you press the right button, it goes right down. But I don't like that because I feel dizzy if I go down too much at the back.
And finally, here you are now at Bass Reunion, Marguerite Bay Reunion, I should say.
And I must admit, it's much nicer than the one I went to before.
Good.
Which was a bit sort of just noisy, and we all sat at trestle tables, so there were loads of people there, and Alan Precious came up and spoke to me, but I didn't remember him, but I remember his name now, and about three other men came up and said who they were. and I was fumbling with my brain thinking, why won't it tell me who you are and which one you were walking up the the main road?
Well, I saw Alan on Thursday.
Oh, did you? Yes.
Yeah, he's 84 now.
Oh, I thought they'd all be in their mid or late 80s, yeah, because he's doing fine. Lovely. Well, when you see him again, do tell him that I came and we had an interview and I told loads of maybe stories.
Colleen, that's been lovely. Thank you so much.
Oh, good. Well, I hope you get a few little words from that you can put in your archives.
Don't worry,
putting them
will.
In a bottle and putting them out to sea to see if they'll end up on an iceberg
somewhere. They might sink.
Yes.